On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. The Walters Art Museum is known around the world for a wide-ranging collection that ranges from the antiquity to the early 20th century. The museum was established by the 19th century tycoon William Walters and later run by his son Henry to house their personal collection of European art. Zoe Washington Sheff is our resident fashion guru. Zoe's a stylist, a fashion editor, and the CEO of the fashion consulting company Little Bird. Last week, Zoe and producer Jonna McCone went to the Walters to explore its collection of jewelry and how the ornate Victorian styles of the past are referenced in today's style and on the red carpet. So, Zoe, first of all, welcome. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
And so what drew you to the Walters?
Well, the Walters has such an impressive collection of statement jewelry from the likes of Rene Lalique and Louis Comfort Tiffany. So it was a natural transition.
So you and our producer, Jonna McCone, went down there. Who'd you talk to?
We went down there. We spoke to Jo Briggs, who's the associate curator of 18th and 19th century art at the Walters. She's amazing.
Great. Let's take a listen.
We're here in the Grand Salon, is that correct?
This is the World's Fair Room. We're right off the Grand Salon.
Right off the Grand Salon. I love this room, by the way, because it's so dramatic and ornate, and I just want to put on a ball gown and move in, basically.
Thank you for saying that. We had a lot of fun installing it and choosing the colors.
And we're here looking at your amazing collection of Tiffany and Lalique pieces. A lot of people don't really know who Rene Lalique is. Do you mind speaking to who he is as a designer?
He was an incredibly innovative guy, and he is a really important part of the Art Nouveau artistic style, the trend for which kind of swept the world around 1900. He is probably best known for his later, more mass-produced glassware, so like perfume bottles, car hood ornaments, and vases. But prior to launching that very successful business in glass, he actually got his start in his career with very high-end bespoke jewelry. And this is really in the period from about 1890 through to about 1910, so what's known as the Belle Epoque in Paris, the beautiful era. And he, in this moment, he's really associating himself with some very famous women who he learns a lot from. They're his muses. And then he subsequently trades that fame into this very successful glass business, which is really for a much wider audience. You didn't have to be Sarah Bernhardt or a famous actress to buy the perfume bottles, but you certainly had to be a very special woman to commission and wear some of these high-end jewelry pieces that he was making at that time.
Which is interesting, because I think that business model really translates today to a lot of modern jewelry houses. But first things first, let's talk about how you guys acquired these amazing pieces.
That's a great question. What are these things doing in Baltimore? What are these icons of Art Nouveau in Paris doing here? Well, it's really a story about our founder, and that is a man called Henry Walters. He was born in 1848, and when he died in 1931, he left his amazing art collection to the city of Baltimore. He traveled around a lot, and that's really the key to how these pieces ended up here. So he was in Paris in 1900 for the World's Fair. And these events happened very regularly in the 19th century, and they showcased art and industry from across the world. And Henry attended them religiously, as his father did. And so in 1900 in Paris, he sees the incredibly innovative display by René Lalique. And it was beautiful. It had dragonfly women with gauzy wings, and Lalique hung all of his jewelry off of these wings. And it got a lot of great press at the time. Unfortunately, most of the pieces were already sold. So when Lalique shows for the first time in America in a big way, it's actually another World's Fair, St. Louis, 1904. And Henry, because he knows Lalique is so good, he gets right to the front of the line, and he ends up buying 9 pieces, which are now in the Walters Art Museum. And most of them are on display in this fourth floor gallery.
Is it typical for a man like Henry Walters to buy up 9 or 10 pieces of Lalique jewelry for the sake of collecting, or would they perhaps been designed to wear? Was there someone in his life that he might want to have given this to, or was it only for the collection?
Well, in this case, it's only for the collection. Henry did marry, but very late in life and well after he bought this jewelry. He was likely modeling his buying habits on that of another very wealthy man who made his money in the oil industry, and that's Colas Gulbenkian. And Gulbenkian actually founded a museum in Lisbon. And he actually bought 150 pieces from Lalique, commissioned and bought them. And so that was really, I think, although we have no documentary evidence to prove it, I think Henry was looking at Gulbenkian as a model for a museum, someone who was building a museum who was buying from Lalique. And so Henry wanted to put his collection on a par with that of Gulbenkian, and hence these nine pieces ended up here. They went straight from the World's Fair to the museum. Visitors are always asking me, were other pieces like this one? Right. And the answer is that yes, they were, but it did take a very special kind of woman to do that.
So does Lalique have a sort of harem of women that are his muses or his patrons? And what was that relationship like with the women who he serviced?
He was a very smart businessman. He certainly did very well out of these relationships with extremely high-profile women. But what I also want to emphasize is that it's really a symbiotic relationship. These women aren't just clothes sources or models for Lalique. He's actually taking something from them and using it in his innovative jewelry. So just to give an example of that, he works very closely with Sarah Bernhardt, who's probably the most famous actress in the 19th century, internationally famous, touring in Europe and America. And she collaborated with Lalique at least twice, and perhaps more often. It's always hard to know with Sarah Bernhardt exactly who came up with the idea, because she was very hands-on, and she controlled her image very carefully. So when she was acting on the stage, she collaborated in designing the sets, the costumes, and also the very large theatrical jewelry that she wore on stage. He made a very large blue lotus that she wore in the role of Isley, and he also made a very, very large pearl lily tiara that she wore in her role as the faraway princess. So if you look at our very beautiful orchid comb, you see how huge it is. It's probably, what, about 26 centimeters high, maybe about 20 centimeters across, so about 8 inches. And it's huge. It's a statement piece for sure. And I think he was learning about the importance of scale.
You know, you mentioned multiple times the idea of Art Nouveau and how dramatic these pieces are. Can you just explain a little bit for our listeners exactly what constitutes an Art Nouveau jewelry piece?
Art Nouveau, obviously in French, it simply means new art. It actually is taken from the name of a store, and that was La Maison de l'Art Nouveau, so the house of the new art.
Where Lalique was sold.
Yes, and Lalique sold at the store, and this opened in 1895. The style is really characterized by curving lines. So they were often looking for inspiration to nature, to the female form, to hair, to smoke. And they're incorporating these into jewelry, into architecture, into furniture design. It's really a style that crosses all the different art forms at this moment.
Historically, at this time period, around the late 19th century, why would you say that people are now relying on influences from nature and these sort of curvilinear forms?
It's a complicated situation, but it's somewhat a reaction to industrialization and mass production. So Lalique actually spent some time in England, and the famous kind of exponent of the arts and crafts style is William Morris. And so I think what happens is Lalique is picking up on some of these arts and crafts ideas. And the arts and crafts movement really reacted against, you know, big factory production that really dehumanized the workers and wanted to turn back to a much more creative work environment for people in general. Having said that, one of the things that Lalique was criticized for was that his work was so high-end, it couldn't possibly reach everybody. And one of the aims of the arts and crafts movement is that it would impact the way that people were living their everyday lives. So particular simple kinds of furniture, very beautifully designed cutlery, for example. But Lalique was obviously aiming at the wealthy. And this was actually something people picked up on and criticized him for at the time.
Would you also say that this kind of coincides with the establishing of the first real mega brands? Now you see, you know, everybody knows Tiffany, Bulgari, Cartier, and I feel like Lalique seems like someone who was becoming a brand more so than just a designer.
Lalique really does become a brand. But he's using this formative moment where he's making these high-end one-off pieces for a particularly famous set of women to springboard into that mass production. And it's a little bit like, I always think about, you know, the Oscar red carpet. Mm-hmm. You see somebody wearing, say, Dolce & Gabbana. There's no way that I, as a museum curator, could afford to buy a Dolce & Gabbana dress, but I might be able to afford the perfume or the sunglasses. There's a very similar thing happening with Lalique. And it's certainly the 19th century, when people are moving to the cities, literacy is increasing, print technology is increasing, photography allows you to actually see people wearing this jewelry and clothes for the first time. It's a time when people are maybe able to afford a few luxuries. And so it's a really important moment for, as you're saying, the sort of the start of that brand culture. Lalique was super, super smart in getting his messaging across and creating a lot of longevity for his firm.
This is the time where you see, for the first time, someone really using the star power of his associations, his amazing designs, knowing that they're unconventional, playing into that, and building a brand off of it, and almost creating diffusion lines with the glassware, which have equal amounts of creativity and craftsmanship, but taking it to a more mass market level.
And I think what's really interesting about this period is maybe prior to this, it had mostly been aristocratic women, so say Queen Victoria, that was setting style. But at this moment, it's shifting more towards actresses, even courtesans. So high-end prostitutes were setting the fashion in Paris, and they were being written up in the newspapers. And so they were getting a lot more exposure than previously.
So when you were speaking about René Lalique's relationship with his muses, I'll say, you spoke about size and sort of impact. Would you say that this is the heyday for statement jewelry?
I think about this in the sense of fashion cycles. There's always moments in history where huge pieces of jewelry are in vogue, and then it kind of swings back the other way, and very delicate small pieces become fashionable. But certainly, I think, in terms of the innovative combination of materials that's going on at this time, it's really a very high point for jewelry innovation in general.
As I look around at these amazing pieces, they call to mind a lot of contemporary designers and their influence, whether it's from nature or even just the techniques mm-hmm. and the unconventional combination of materials that are used. When people typically think of statement jewelry, I was saying earlier, they think of gigantic gems and almost like the queen's jewelry, whereas here it's a lot more subtle, even though it's hugely impactful. When I look at this tiger necklace, for example, to me, immediately when I see it, it reminds me of several contemporary designers now, like Lulu Frost, Oscar de la Renta, where you see these really great pieces of horn and enamel and motifs from nature in a very wearable silhouette. So this round collar that would sit very close to the neck, and it would almost become an addition to whatever clothing you were wearing and would become that statement piece. This looks just like something I saw at J. Crew, for example.
For sure. I mean, Lalique's influence really has a very, very long moment. This kind of way of combining, so in this piece, for example, the necklace that we're talking about here, the tiger necklace, it's from about 1903. It combines gold, which, you know, that's pretty typical for jewelry, but it also has enamel and horn, so an organic material, as well as tortoise shell and agate. And it's a pretty fierce piece. So mm-hmm. it has all these tigers that are kind of going in a procession all around it, but it's interspersed with these pointed pieces of horn. It's something that feels very contemporary. I could totally imagine walking into a high-end jewelry store and seeing this for sale today. And so it's kind of amazing that, you know, it's over 110 years old.
Exactly.
And it just shows how cutting-edge Lalique was, that it formally still has a real resonance for us and speaks to us.
Joe Briggs is the Associate Curator of 18th and 19th Century Art at the Walters Art Museum. Our fashion guru, Zoe Washington Sheff, and producer, Jonna McCone, spoke with her earlier this month. So, Zoe, that was really fun to hear. Now that you're back from the museum, I wonder if the patrons of the art of the turn of the century, are they like parallel to today's celebrities?
They are. It's really amazing because when you look at the Oscars or the Golden Globes, you always see these celebrities walking the red carpet with these gigantic Cartier necklaces or Bulgari necklaces. But on a more intimate
level, they have relationships with these jewelry houses where they really influence the design themselves and it reflects their own sense of personal style. So they're both building a brand in a way.
Mm-hmm. And just like the old days. I mean, they were people
just
building
like
brands.
Just like the old days, yeah. Building the brands. And really, René Lalique is a great example of that. He really used his star power and the star power of his glam squad to build his brand.
So now, do you think that we'll be seeing more stuff about fashion and lifestyle exhibits at museums like the Walters? I mean, there's this great, you know, austere house of, you know, antique art and all that stuff.
Oh, I do. I do. I think people are really interested in it. I think it adds another layer to what you typically see in editorial, online. Creating that sense of gravitas behind fashion and art is really important, and it really puts it in a special context so people understand why they're wearing what they're wearing.
Because I guess it's almost kind of amazing to think that some of the stuff that's at the Walters, women actually wore.
This
was day-to-day jewelry.
Exactly. And when you see people today, people invest in jewelry like that today. So it's really great to have that sense of continuity.
All right. Zoe Washington Sheff. She's a stylist, a fashion editor, and the CEO of the fashion consulting company Little Bird. She's a regular contributor here on Maryland Morning. The exhibit at the Walters, it's called From Rye to Raphael, and it features the jewelry of Tiffany and Lalique. It's there until the end of March. We've got info at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks, Zoe. We'll see you soon.
Thank you so much.
I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Lots more coming up. Thank you.